It's time for security now. Steve Gibson is here with the latest security news. He's going to talk about that, of course, widespread internet DDoS attack from last week, and have an info on a brand new exploit. It was embargoed last week and can talk about it now. DRammer. We'll show you how to test your Android device for it. It's coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 583, recorded Tuesday, October 25th, 2016, DRammer. Security Now is brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Go to ring.com/securitynow and get up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit with their limited time offer. And by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter the promo code SecurityNow to receive a free Tracker Bravo with any purchase. And by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy and entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/securitynow and use the code SN30. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security and safety and privacy online with this guy right here, Steve Gibson of the GRC Corporation. Live long and stay safe. There he is.
I promised last week that I already knew the title of today's podcast. And I was under embargo. I was brought in by the guys who did the flip feng shui some time ago, a slightly different crew that also involves three researchers from Santa Barbara, in addition to the guys at the V University in Amsterdam. And I was informed of what was going on under the agreement that I would abide by their disclosure timeline. So, and of course, that was before the internet melted down at the end of last week, which actually affected me in two interesting ways that I'll share when we get to that. So there was some competition for like what's the week's biggest story. So anyway, I settled on DRammer, which is the name they've given to this next generation Rowhammer DRAM memory bit hammering exploit. But this is significant because they answered the question of whether this could be done on ARM platform mobile devices in the affirmative. Uh-oh. Which was not believed to be possible. And remember that I described the flip feng shui as a sublime hack. I mean, just, and you know, I'll quickly review it when we start talking about this at the end of the podcast, but this is equally sublime. I mean, these guys are good. So, you know, it's just, I'm just so happy that they're on our side and that they're working to reveal flaws and responsibly disclose, as they have to Google. Google informed their upstream partners or downstream partners, I'm not sure which way the stream flows, a month ago. Although, while there is some mitigation possible, the underlying problem, as we've discussed when we've discussed Rowhammer for the last couple of years, it was in 2014 that this first emerged as a problem, it is a hardware flaw. And so while you can sort of dance around and make it more difficult to leverage the flaw into an exploit, everything we see as we look at the history of these things over time is that something that like looks like a problem, but oh, it's nothing to worry about. Well, give it a year and someone figures out how to make it a big worry. So that's the main focus. But of course, we're going to talk about last week's powerful denial of service attack. Linux has a new problem. that Linus himself wrote about. It was actually a problem he took some responsibility for 9 years ago, known as Dirty Cow. Cow, C-O-W, is the abbreviation for copy on write. It turns out there's a longstanding race condition in all Linux kernels, which is really critical. Essentially, any web-exposed Linux server is vulnerable. So all of our listeners who have Linux or web-facing Linux servers need to understand what's going on and get themselves patched. Oh, and it was discovered in the wild. So this is unlike, for example, DRAMer, which is a researcher-driven theoretical problem that they've made real. This was discovered from traffic analysis happening to someone's server. We also sort of related to that an interesting look at the average lifetime of Linux bugs. There was a study done about 6 years ago, and that's been updated by a Google researcher, and nothing has changed, unfortunately. We have a little bit of errata and miscellany, and then, as I said, we'll do a take a real close look at the details of this latest Rowhammer exploit, DRAMer, as they call it, which is quite a concern. So lots of good stuff to talk about.
It's going to be a good show. Looking forward to it. Let's pause briefly before we get to the news of the week. And the news of the week is going to talk a little bit about the danger of Internet of Things devices. And here we go with an Internet of Things device. But I have to say, I use this and I feel completely safe using it. It's the Ring video doorbell. And here's why. And Steve, I'm sure, will back this up. We know that Ring, from the very beginning, has built in the capability, key capability, to update this firmware, and will do so. And if exploits are found, we'll fix them.
And it's the first thing it does, because you never know how long it's been sitting on a shelf if you pick it up at retail. So the first thing it does when it comes live is check in with the mothership and get it, you know, and update itself to everything that's known.
Yeah, I wish all IoT devices did this. However, you know, one of the reasons we have so many IoT devices, more than several billion, according to IDG, is because they're useful. Connecting something in your home to the internet can be very handy. In the case of the doorbell, more than handy, really a lifesaver for me, the Ring video doorbell. Now, Ring is a phenomenal company. They just raised a bunch of money from the creator of Virgin, Richard Branson. I think he led a $28 million investment. And what they've done is they've expanded the line. So let me show you. This was the original, the Ring video doorbell. It's the one I have. Very easy to install. If you have a wired doorbell, or even if you don't, because the original Ring has a large lithium-ion rechargeable battery, even comes with a cable. About once a year, you'll charge it up. And what does it give you? Well, of course, it rings your doorbell. Somebody comes to your door and presses the button, it's going to ring your doorbell. But more than that, because it's tied to your internet, when somebody rings your doorbell rings on the Ring app on your Mac, on your Windows PC, on your phone, on your tablet, wherever you set it up, and lets you know somebody's ringing your doorbell. It then turns on the camera, speaker, and microphone that's built in. You can see them. You can talk to them. You can say things like, "Who are you? Get away from my house. I'm just getting my gun. I'll be right there." Or, "Leave the package. I'm in the shower, but I'll be right out." That kind of thing. So it really is nice. It also has a motion detector, and it's completely adjustable. So you can set the sensitivity and the angle of view. So I have it set just if somebody comes up my front steps. I will get a notification as well on my phone or my tablet, and I can see who's there. And I can talk to them, too. I love this. The kit's nice. It comes with everything you need. Screws if you need it. You probably won't, but if you actually, you do need the screws. A drill bit if you need it. That you probably won't. A level, the special a screwdriver handle and the special Torx bit that you need, and the regular Phillips bit. All you need, and I'm no handyman. I installed this very quickly, less than an hour. They've got videos online and everything. Now, I love it. I get a notification when somebody's on my front stoop, when somebody's walking up the steps, when somebody's package is being delivered. I love the Ring video doorbell. Now, as I said, thanks to the investment by Richard Branson, they've added a lot of additional things. They've got a new Ring Pro with a 7. This is a 780p camera. The new one has a 1080p camera and doesn't have a battery. So if you want a slimmer video doorbell and you already have a wired doorbell, that's perfect for you. They also have a they've taken the doorbell out and they have a what they call a stick-up cam. It's the same exact camera, microphone and speaker as in the Ring video doorbell. You can put that anywhere, and they even can they even sell you a solar panel, so you don't even have to wire it at all. It just connected to your Wi-Fi. The solar panel charges up. It's got a battery in it. It keeps it going all day, all night. So you can see where you can't see from the front, you know, of your house. You can see what's going on the side or the back. They also make a chime that you just plug into the wall, and that'll ring. So if there's parts of your house where you can't hear the doorbell ring, or maybe your workshop, you know, you put that in there. They just they've got it all, and every they've got it in a kit now. The Ring of Security kits they call them, and every Ring of Security kit comes with the lit up Ring video doorbell sign. It's a solar powered sign. Goes in front of your house. Let the bad guys know you're under surveillance. Bad guys, stay away. I love that. So here's the deal: go to ring.com/security now, and you'll save up to $150 off the Ring of Security kits, depending on which one you get. ring.com/security now. Join the millions of homeowners, including me, and many of our employees, and many of our family members who protect our homes with the Ring video doorbell. This is one IoT device I really love. I can really get behind. ring.com/security now. And we thank them so much for their support. And of course, as you know, when you buy it at that address, ring.com/security now, it helps keep us afloat. And I know that this is one show of all the shows we do. Nobody wants to lose the great Security Now program.
You know, and it sort of brings the point to bear, along with this week's picture of the week in the show notes, that not all of these connected things really justify their connectivity. Yeah, I mean, you've got to, you know, you're it's sort of a reach, for example, where when you've got like an internet-connected coffee pot, it's like, okay, right. Well, right. You know, yeah, I guess I could start brewing while I'm you know, stuck in traffic, so the pot is ready for me when I get home. But
there are some things that are really useful too, and so yes. that's the thing is, you know, be judicious. I mean, the widespread. I mean, you can't not connect an internet a router to the internet, right? So make sure you get one that's well designed, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you know, in this. Several people sent me this The Joy of Tech cartoon.
I have it here, so I'll show
it. It was titled The Internet of Ransomware Things, where the smoke alarm up on the ceiling is saying, $30 in Bitcoin, or next time I smell smoke, I might just let you sleep. Or the dishwasher says, your dirty dishes could wait. I'm busy mining Bitcoins. And the lamp hanging from the ceiling and the camera sitting on the counter says, excuse us while we participate in a DDoS attack.
Yikes. That's a little too close to home, huh?
It is all too close to, yes. So anyway, this is just full of, it shows a little robot vacuum zooming around saying, wire my hacker $100 or I'll reverse my motor and blow dirt all over the place.
That's pretty funny. This is Nitrozak and Snaggy. We love The Joy of Tech. And of course, they do the album art for this show. Nitrozak did that great illustration of Steve, which we're going to maybe have to update. I think your mustache has gotten a little grayer.
Yeah, and I always looked a little snootier in that than I thought that I
We could get another one. We'll go get another one. She's very kind. She updates those.
Anyway, so clearly they know their IoT problems because they pretty much nailed every, you know, bad thing that could happen. I was tempted to call this Attack of the Light Bulbs. Or then in homage to an old internet meme that you'll of course remember, all your light bulbs belong to us. So my own intersection with last week's problem was when I received at about 7:30 in the morning an iMessage from Sue, my bookkeeper. She had been away from the office for about a week, traveling with her laptop and, you know, checking in constantly to deal with any sales.grc related mail stuff. And she sent me a note saying that Eudora, yes, we're all still using Eudora, was returning grc.com address not resolved error. And And I thought, well, that's odd. And so I shot her a text note back and said, well, okay, that doesn't really sound like our problem, but I'll look into it. And then, like maybe 2 hours later, I got an alert saying that one of GRC's e-commerce transactions had failed. And I do – if the GRC server is unable to connect to our merchant gateway through which we process customer credit card transactions, it waits like a few seconds and tries again. So it does 10 retries and then declares a failure and then returns a response to the user through the web page that something outside of our control is preventing us from successfully completing the charge. You know, it's not you got the zip code wrong or your street address doesn't match. It's something else. So that happened. Someone was determined to buy a copy of SpinRite. So I had to listen to 30 individual sets of – or three sets of 10, so 30 total error messages. It generates the Star Trek hailing whistle, and then a voice says something about – exactly. E-commerce transaction retry, and then does that 10 times, and then e-commerce transaction failure. So I always know what's going on. So then I started seeing the news about a DNS-related outage. And that, of course, put all the pieces together for me. That explained why Sue, wherever she was at down like in Texas or somewhere, where for whatever DNS server her location was using was unable to obtain the IP for GRC. And suddenly I thought, I'll bet you that's what's happening because of the coincidence that GRC's e-commerce system was unable to obtain through DNS lookup, the IP for the merchant gateway. But I was able to get it from here as a Cox subscriber. So I looked up the IP, jumped over to GRC's server, and dropped an entry into the hosts file. And as we all know, the hosts file, even today, is, and this is on a Windows 2008 R2 server, so a recent server, it looks in the hosts file first. Well, what I found, interestingly, was I had already commented out the line I was going to put in. In other words, this had happened previously. So all I did was I removed the pound sign from the front of that line because the IP had not changed from whenever it was I had done that before. And then immediately e-commerce transactions started to process again. So we had a big DNS problem. And of course, everybody knows about last week's massive outage. Now, I think what surprised people, though, was, well, several things. Our listeners know enough to wonder why DNS caching didn't mask the problem. And I will explain why that is. But essentially, there was a company based on the East Coast, Dyn, that is the authoritative name server for, as we learned, many major providers, meaning that service – and I mean Dyn is a major DNS provider.
So are they one of the 13 or are they a subsidiary to the main phone books?
They're not the root servers.
Root servers, yeah.
They would, for example, be the they offer the servers that a domain registrar points to. So, for example, you know, if you look up that Twitter.com's registrar, that whoever they're using, you know, very much the way, for example, I'm using Hover right now. So at For the domains I have at Hover, I've given them the level 3 servers that GRC uses. And so those are the authoritative domain name servers for GRC. That is, though, that's where GRC.com's DNS records are. And so it turns out that many of these large companies have outsourced their DNS. You know, being me, of course, I don't. I do my own. And in fact, I actually have the root server, and level threes are slaves. So that they actually handle all of the traffic, but they obtain the what's known as the GRC.com zone record from my master server, which is a free BSD Unix machine. So these major companies just thought, you know, there's no value to be added by DNS. And they also wanted, you know, they're much larger than GRC. I'm fine having two strong level three DNS servers serve GRC's DNS. But, you know, Twitter and Amazon AWS and, you know, huge internet presences, they really need multiple physical presences, you know, multiple points of presence. So West Coast, East Coast, international, and so forth, so that the world's DNS queries are not all just pounding on one or two servers, but are being distributed by essentially the equivalent of a content distribution network for name services. And that's what Dyn offers. The problem
is, using Hover, I didn't go down. Because correct. I was using what they chose, but you are doing your own.
Correct.
Got it.
And so, yeah, so you could use Hover's DNS, or as I do, I could point my Hover registration record at level three's DNS. And instead, they, like Twitter, has pointed their registrations record at Dyn's DNS servers.
Oh, so it's because you were using level three that you got hit.
No, it's actually that whoever – well, for example, my merchant account company was using Dyn.
So your GRC wasn't down.
Correct.
But you couldn't take a credit card.
Correct.
Got it.
And wherever Sue was, her DNS provider was somehow affected by this too. So anyway, it was a wake-up call that so many major sites could be taken down by an attack on one part of the infrastructure. And, you know, we've often talked about, because we've talked about DNS often, it is UDP protocol, which is meant to be lightweight. And what that means is that it is inherently spoofable. TCP connections cannot be spoofed because you need that three-way handshake. Packets have to be able to make a successful round trip from each endpoint to the other and back in order for a TCP connection to be completed and connected. But that's an overhead that simple lookup services minimize, so they simply just send off an unverified UDP packet towards its destination. And if they get a response, that's great. It was very quick and inexpensive. If they don't, they wait a minute, well, not a minute, but a few seconds, and then they try again. So they take responsibility for trying to get a response. But what that also means is that, for example, they're able to deliberately rewrite the outgoing packet's apparent source IP to mask their actual source IP. And if those illegitimate source IPs are allowed out onto the internet, and that's, you know, something we've talked about often, the whole issue of egress filtering, where ISPs currently do allow packets that cannot have whose packets are clearly could be known to the ISP to be falsifying their return address, essentially their source IP. All the ISPs know if packets are leaving that could never back, if they're an illegitimate source IP, they arguably should be dropped on site. They should just simply be ignored. But that's not happening today. So there is actually there is an RFC and a proposal, BCP-38. And the RFC is 2827, which is titled Network ingress filtering, defeating denial of service attacks which employ IP source address spoofing. And there's even an acronym for a movement that is trying to get itself going called SAVE, which is Source Address Validation Everywhere. The implication being there are even choke points where, you know, and I've talked about this too, a router in the middle of the internet has a routing table that tells it which connections to send packets to based on where they're going. But that can also infer which connections packets can have come from. And so even routers in arbitrary locations could be made smarter and to recognize packets which cannot be valid. But again, nobody's doing that. So, and as we talked about this last week, it was funny because you and I were talking about IoT and about source address spoofing. And I mentioned that, unfortunately, there were other attacks that did not rely on spoofed source addresses. And so those would pass right through such filters. And in fact, the attacks last week did not rely on whether they spoofed their source addresses or not, and they may have because they were DNS attacks, but they didn't need to. Okay, so Dine wrote something sort of a not saying very much corporate level speak. In their blog posting under what we know, they said, at this point, we know this was a sophisticated, highly distributed attack involving tens of millions of IP addresses. We are conducting a thorough root cause and forensic analysis and will report what we know in a responsible fashion. The nature and source of the attack is under investigation, but it was a sophisticated attack across multiple attack vectors and internet locations. We can confirm, with the help of analysis from Flashpoint and Akamai, that one source of the traffic for the attacks were devices infected by the Mirai botnet. We observed tens of millions of discrete IP addresses, now, assuming those were not spoofed, because of course, if they're just pseudo random, then they could easily be not tens of millions, but you know, 10, pretending to be more. But we now know that this is a huge botnet. Okay, so what was interesting as I dug into this is that I looked at some of the traffic that this Mirai was using, and it looked disturbingly familiar because I realized that it was using a weaponized version of the technique I used 6 years ago when I wrote GRC's DNS benchmark and GRC's DNS spoofability testing. For the benchmark, I explicitly need to bypass caching because the DNS benchmark wants to determine how fast your local DNS caches are, but it wants to separate that from the speed of the authoritative name server that is the ultimate source of the DNS information. The way I do that is I create made-up domain names, pseudo-random gibberish, for example, .something.com. And so the idea is, since that pseudo-random gibberish cannot yet exist in the local DNS resolver, it is forced to shrug and forward it to the authoritative name server to see if that's a domain that the authoritative name server knows about. So this is a deliberate cache busting technique, And unfortunately, it's what Mirai uses, whereas I was very careful never to use this to overload any DNS server. And in fact, one of the things that the DNS benchmark does, it wants to determine the reliability, the response reliability of the servers that it is benchmarking. So I do not want to clog the channel, which would cause a false positive packet loss. So I meter these queries out, only allowing one to be in flight at any time to any given server of the batch that are under test. Of course, Mirai wants to attack remote DNS servers. And so, see, what it needs to do, it must bypass its local ISP cache. Because if it simply asks for Twitter.com, well, if the local cache run by its ISP wasn't already aware of Twitter.com, and it almost certainly would already have that in its cache, but if it wasn't, then it would have to make a query to Twitter.com's authoritative name server in order to determine what Twitter.com's current IP is. And so that's where it goes to the root, the .com servers, essentially, in order to look up Twitter.com. Then it goes to Twitter.com's server to see, you know, like what Twitter.com's current IP is. So, but the point is that if say like an aberrant DVR, because we know that a lot of these were commandeered DVRs, if the DVR made a query once, it might force the local DNS server to look up Twitter.com. But now it's in that local DNS server's, that local resolver's cache. So all subsequent queries for Twitter.com would not bother the actual Twitter.com DNS server because they're now cached. And so what I did many, many years ago, and even do now for the spoofability testing, is I deliberately make up fake domain names, subdomains, in order to get queries from, in order to send queries through the cache to get to the actual servers. These guys are doing it to attack the servers. So that's a cache bypassing attack, which as we've seen, is super effective. Now, our listeners wondered why a DNS server going down, an authoritative DNS server, why wouldn't that be buffered by valid caching for valid domain queries? And the answer is, it certainly was. But the problem is, not only do you have the IP address in a domain record, but the domain owner is able to set the cache duration as part of the DNS record. They're able to specify, once this is queried, how long they want that result to survive out in the internet's caches. And unfortunately, not everyone has those set optimally. There are instances where you would deliberately want it to be shorter. For example, when many years ago I was moving GRC from behind my two T1s, where it lived for a long time, over to level 3, that meant the GRC.com had to, I was going to completely change all the IP addresses from the block that I had with Cogent, who was my bandwidth provider, over to a block that I had been assigned by level 3. So what I did a couple days before this planned changeover, and everyone will remember that it was, you know, planned as being kind, because suddenly I lost my connection and I called them up. I say, hey, what happened? And they said, didn't you get the mail? I go, no, I haven't had that email address for 10 years. So anyway, it was a little bit of a fire drill around here. But the point is that knowing that it was going to happen, I shortened GRC's DNS to 15 minutes. And I did it a day before. So what that meant was that essentially I drained the cache, or at least I drained the long expiration cache out of the internet. And it took, if it had been previously set for 8 hours, I don't remember now if it was 8 or 24, but I had to wait at least, I had to keep the old IP at least as long as the cache had been, so that all DNS servers on the internet would have come back and refreshed themselves. But when doing so, they would be refreshing themselves with the 15-minute, the very short duration DNS record, that would then force them to come back every 15 minutes and get an update. So what that meant was, when I did bring up the new servers at level 3 and then changed the GRC's DNS, within 15 minutes, the entire internet was informed of that change, because I had planned it that way. And so there wasn't a big outage. If my DNS, for example, had been set to 24 hours of caching, and I had made, and something had forced me to make an unplanned emergency change, it would be staggered through the 24 hours, because DNS resolvers all over the internet would have different comeback times, but the oldest of the caches wouldn't have expired for a full day before it got news of the new IP. So the point is that if these major companies had their caching set to 24 hours, there still may have been some outage, but it would have been spotty. It would have been so the point is that the authoritative name servers were effectively DDoSed off the air. So nobody was able to refresh their cache with new information. But if these major, like, you know, Twitter and others had set very long records, and they could do that if they had a known stable IP address, then they could better survive a few hours here and there of shortage. Some people would see an outage. Others would have their local resolvers would have been able to keep the cached information for a much longer period of time and would have never had to come back and update themselves. So so that's the whole story of what happened. And stepping back from this a little bit, I was reminded of a comment that our friend Bruce Schneier made recently regarding IoT device security. He said, the market can't fix this because neither the buyer nor the seller cares. Now, of course, that's not true of our listeners, but look at all the DVRs that are out there.
I think people are caring a little more than they did before.
Yeah.
They'll care. Xiang Mai, that made most of these devices, has already started to update them and do recalls and stuff. They're a Chinese company.
Well, and to threaten suing Brian Krebs and others.
Suing Brian Krebs?
Yes, for saying that he's maliciously reporting and blaming them for the whole attack. They're denying that they're as responsible as they are. Mm. So it's like, okay, well, you know, play the game.
That's a problem.
Yeah.
That does validate what you just said. They don't care.
Yeah. I should mention also that we've talked about the Shodan search engine, which is scouring the internet and logging anything it finds. There is a simple IoT scanner which makes a query of Shodan for a user's IP to see if any given user's IP exists in Shodan's database.
Oh, that's nice.
It's IoT scanner. iotscanner.bullgard.com. iotscanner.bullgard.com. It gives you a nice presentation and just explains that if you click this button, it'll check Shodan for you to see if you are listed. I pressed it and I wasn't. I pass it on to my buddy who's gone IoT crazy. And although he's got the three dumb router configuration and he's isolated. And yep, and good. You are not public on Shodan. You can do a deeper drill as the next phase, but they warn you that if you do, then you may that may bring you to Shodan's attention where you may not have been there otherwise.
Why would I not want to be brought to their attention? I have now, apparently. I just pressed the button.
Yeah, and I think that probably they're doing enough job of scanning, and good, no vulnerabilities found
now,
again.
That's this is here, of course, and we've got Astero routers in between us and security boxes in between us and the outside world. So,
well, so of course, that's the problem, too. It's why I referred to, someday considering doing a comprehensive 65K or 64, depending on how you count, port scan, because what a lot of these IoT devices do is they leverage universal plug and play in people's routers in order to open up incoming ports to themselves. I mean, that's the only way something out on the internet can find your DVR. If the DVR has as part of its setup and configuration, opened up an incoming port to itself. And unfortunately, Shields Up doesn't currently find that. And it's very labor intensive. It's not something you can scan for inside your network. You need somebody to scan for you on your behalf outside your network. And so it might be worth having our listeners use this iotscanner.bullgard.com just to make sure that there's nothing that they've got flapping in the breeze publicly that they're not aware of.
You can't provide it with an IP address. It just checks the network you're currently on. It'd be nice if I could say, because I'd like to check my home address right now, but I'll have to.
Well, it would be nice, although, of course, that's subject to abuse.
Right.
I do the same thing with Shields Up. I will test where you are connecting from,
right,
but I do not let you put an arbitrary IP address in, because, of course, people would then be using me to scan other people.
Right, exactly.
Nah,
let's check to see how safe they are. Yeah, I don't blame you.
So, anyway, there's nothing we can do except protect ourselves. And I don't know how this gets resolved. As Bruce said, the problem is, you go to Amazon and people are clicking buttons to download, light bulbs and baby cams and all this stuff. And they're fun, but they're creating a problem, not only for, I was explaining to my friend who's like, he's always showing me this, pictures around his home when we're out grabbing a bite. And I go, that's good. And at this point, these devices are of interest to attackers for use in commandeering them for attacks like we saw last week. That's sort of the low-hanging fruit. Eventually, they're going to get around to poking around inside people's networks this absolutely can be done. If you've got these DVRs, which have had malicious software installed in them, this Mirai botnet, then it does exist only in RAM. As we know, if you reboot these devices, that flushes it out. But if they remap a port and go public again, they're infected within 5 minutes. So because there are so many of these things now scanning for others. But what this means is that you've got remotely controlled malware on your internal home network, and it has full visibility to the net it has access to. So, there's never been a better case for network segmentation that we've been talking about now for quite a while. You have to have these, your high value computing resources separated from stuff that's just that you can't and no one can reasonably represent are secure. And ultimately, we're going to see people beginning to have in right now. It's just using these things for attack. They're going to end up becoming points of intrusion. It's inevitable. So it's
lovely
called
news.
Yes, it's called Dirty Cow. Linus wrote.
Which is not what Donald Trump called Hillary Clinton, I don't believe.
No, that was no. Nasty Woman.
That's right. Okay.
Dirty Cow. So on last Thursday, he does pronounce his name Linus. I always feel self-conscious saying Linus. Yes.
Everybody's saying it's Linus.
I made a point once of listening to him say it of himself. I found some audio of him pronouncing his own name. It's Linus. So he wrote, "This is an ancient bug." He called it ancient. Okay, well, maybe in Torvald's time scale.
Well, it goes back to almost the beginning, right?
Well, 9 years.
Okay, that's a long
time. An ancient bug that was actually attempted to be fixed once, he says in parens, badly by me 11 years ago in a commit, and he gives the commit number.
Wow.
And it was called Fix Get User Pages Race for Write Access, close parens. Then he says, but that was then undone due to problems by a subsequent commit, which was Fix Get User Pages Bug. So he made a fix that he's now unimpressed with, which was then fixed, and that fix broke the kernel in a way 9 years ago that allows this race condition. So but a lot of our listeners don't. A race condition is sort of a famous problem in computing in general, and actually even before that in electrical engineering. It's any situation where two things are not supposed to happen at the same time. That is, they're trying to be mutually exclusive. So that, for example, each one checks to see if the other one has happened, and if not, then it happens and it blocks the other one. But there are, and this is a problem. I've been dealing with it for years. For me, it's just now at an instinctual level I'd handle this, because in multi-threaded code, you've got multiple threads of execution, and when we've got multiple cores, we actually have multiple processors running around in our code at the same time. There are some things, for example, say that you had an increment where you want to increment a value in memory. Well, you do that by reading the current value into a register, incrementing the register, and then writing it back. But say that one thread read the value from memory, and in that instant, that there was a context switch, so that thread was paused while another thread ran. And that other thread read the same value into its context. Then the context switches back, and the first thread increments that and writes it back. Then the second thread increments its copy and writes it back. Well, notice what happened. We intended to have two increments, but only the second one survived because of a race condition where they both had essentially non-exclusive access to a single location in memory. So, and all this causes all kinds of problems in computing, because, for example, many times you have things like reference counts in garbage collection where you need a variable is dynamically allocated, and you need to keep a track of how many different places it's referenced, and you increment that at going upwards. And when you no longer are using that variable, you decrement it going downwards. And when it you when the last process or user to cause it to be decremented to zero allows that to be freed. Well, if your counting has been faulty as a consequence of race conditions, all kinds of havoc. That's where you get memory leaks and buffers that are deleted when they shouldn't be, and nightmares. So this can happen in electronics where you have two edges of two different signals that are not supposed to happen at the same time, and it can happen in OS kernels. So there has been for 9 years an unappreciated race condition in the Linux kernel, and this was discovered by a Phil Oster or Esther, who is a Linux developer who routinely logs all HTTP traffic to his web servers and analyzes it for forensic purposes, just to kind of keep an eye on what's going on. And so a few days ago or last week, he's looking at his logs and processing them however he does, because no doubt that's a lot of data, which is why most people don't keep track of every single query. And he discovers this thing being done to his Linux servers in the wild. So this is a high severity 9-year-old bug in the Linux kernel. Any system running Linux on a web-facing server is vulnerable. It is somebody knows about it and has been exploiting it. It allows an attacker to gain write access to memory that should be read-only, which and it's a big concern because it's not difficult to develop exploits that work reliably. It's located in a section of the Linux kernel that's part of virtually every distribution of Linux that's been released for the last 9 years. It has been fixed, and so Red Hat is aware of it. I saw an announcement from them talking about, you know, this is a zero-day update your Linux kernels. So everybody who's running Linux on web-facing systems needs to get themselves updated, because no doubt bad guys, I mean, now the information is out there. This is where we see a quick escalation in exploits. And it's, you know, it's not difficult to do, which means people are going to be looking for unpatched Linux kernels. And now we have the problem of little small micro Linux kernels in IoT devices that are never going to get patched, and that have been sitting on networks. Maybe they're in closets, maybe they're people's routers, but they're certainly web-facing if they're exposed to the internet. You know, we're in for some interesting times, Leo.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, it's web servers, we should point out. So if you're running Linux at home, unless you're running a server on it, you're not.
No, it's web-exposed servers. So anything with an open port is a server by definition.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So, you know, and so it's not just classic web servers. It's anything that is responding to unsolicited incoming traffic, like all those DVRs that have opened a port. Right. And are like being scanned for and located.
So it could be a remote exploit, but you would have to, well, go to Shields Up, make sure you don't have any open ports. You'd have to have a port open for something on your Linux box, which many people do. I mean, if you allow SSH into a Linux box,
I mean, this is bad.
Or mail server.
Oh, and it takes 5 seconds, by the way. I forgot to mention that.
Oh, well, you didn't mention that. Oh, that, never mind then. Nothing to worry about here.
Wow. So we've got let's take a break. I'm going to refill my coffee and catch my breath.
All right. That I can do, because we're going to talk to you today about something fabulous, the tracker. It's a great way to stop doing what I do all the time, lose my keys. How many hours have you lost to searching for lost keys, lost remote controls, lost pets? The tracker is the solution, a small little coin-sized Bluetooth LE device. I love it. We just got these new trackers with our show album art printed onto it. They have these UV screen printing. It's really cool. But you see how little that is. And what's nice about this compared to other Bluetooth trackers is it's got a removable, replaceable battery in it. So a lot of the other Bluetooth trackers, after a while, months or a year, the battery dies. You throw it out. I don't want to throw this out. I love this thing. I've got it attached to my keys. You can, with the tracker, has a waterproof cover you could put on it that will make it perfect for pets. It's small enough you could even hang it on a cat. Now, it's a two-way tracking device. So the first thing you do is you pair it to your phone. You put the tracker software on your Android or iOS device. Now, that has a map of wherever your tracker is. And you can get up to, what I think, 10? Yeah, 10 different trackers on any given phone. So put it everywhere, right? Put it in your, I know people now are doing it in their luggage, but it's a two-way thing. It's great for keeping track of your phone as well, because if you push the button on the tracker, then it will make your phone scream uncontrollably or whatever sound you would attach to that. It could just be a song or a beep or whatever, even if it's silenced. So you will hear and find your phone. So find your keys, find your phone with the tracker. It also has two-way separation alerts. Now, if you turn those on, it's going to drain the battery faster. But as I said, it's no big deal to replace. These are just those little coin-sized batteries you get at the drugstore. And so if you're the kind of person that leaves your phone behind a lot, the two-way separation alert is great. Leave your keys behind. Your phone will let you know. Leave your phone behind. The tracker will let you know, hey, you left your phone behind. Now, you're smart, so I know you know Bluetooth and Bluetooth LE only have a 30-meter, 100-foot, range. So you might say, well, if I leave my keys, let's say I go to Las Vegas and I'm gambling and I get excited, I win some money and I leave my keys at the blackjack table and then I fly home to Petaluma. Will I still know where my keys are? Well, here's what happens with the tracker. First of all, your phone will always show the last time you saw your tracker. So yes, it'll say, hey, the last time I saw your keys was on that blackjack table. But let's say somebody then moves it. It goes into the lost and found or whatever. So you have an old map on your phone. Well, here's the good thing. They've got a crowd GPS network. Every single person who runs a tracker is also keeping an eye out for your keys. It's like you got 1.5 million helpers all over the world. And when that software on their phone sees your tracker, it says, oh, there are Leo's keys, and sends a message to my software. Does that make sense? So everybody's looking out for you, looking for your keys. It is awesome. It is awesome. Actually, did I say 1.5 million? Update. Tracker's doing so well. They told me they're doing 100,000 a month, something like that. They have 3.5 million trackers now out in the wild. That's the largest crowd GPS network in the world. You will never, ever worry about your keys, your remotes, your luggage again because of the tracker. If you go to the tracker right now, thetracker.com, and you'll get a free Tracker Bravo with your order if you use the offer code security now. So go pick the tracker, get the devices, as many as you need. They're about, I don't know, about $30. They're not expensive. You can get the printing. You can get engraving on them if you want. Get everything you want. Get the waterproof cover. And then use the offer code security now at checkout, and you'll get an extra one free today. Thetracker.com. Use the promo code security now. Love the tracker, and we thank them for supporting Steve and the Security Now show. All right. Did you get your cup of coffee?
I did.
That's a satisfied sigh. That's a very happy man.
I did. So,
all right. On we go.
He spells his name K-E-E-S, but it's pronounced Case. Case Cook is with Google. He describes himself saying, I work for Google on Chrome OS security. Previously, I worked for 5 years at Canonical as an Ubuntu security engineer. My work is to stay alert, curious, and creative while keeping one step ahead of the bad guys. While I'm not working, I've been known to play with Myth TV and generally poke around at video formats. So He last week, he wrote in a blog post, in several of my recent presentations, I've discussed the lifetime of security flaws in the Linux kernel. John Corbett did an analysis in 2010 and found that security bugs appeared to have roughly a five-year lifetime, as in the flaw gets introduced in a Linux release and then goes unnoticed by upstream developers until another release 5 years later, on average. I updated this research for 2011 through 2016 and used the Ubuntu security team's CVE tracker to assist in the process. The Ubuntu kernel team already does the hard work of trying to identify when flaws were introduced in the kernel, which is, you know, really neat to know, you know, like where this came from, which, you know, whenever I find a bug in my own code, I just, everything stops. And I say, okay, how did this happen? Because I want to work on the process rather than just fix the problem. I want to, you know, work on perfecting the technique of not having this happen again. So I'm delighted that they're looking back to determine where this came from to see if they can, you know, if there's anything they can do to improve the process. So he says, so I didn't have to redo this for the 557 kernel CVEs since 2011.
Wow.
Uh-huh. So the numerical summary is critical flaws were two, and they were fixed at 3.3 years of age. High vulnerabilities were 34 of them, fixed at 6.4 years of age on average. There were 334 medium concern vulnerabilities, fixed at an average age of 5.2 years, and then 186 low impact vulnerabilities, fixed at an average of 5 years. So he says this comes out to roughly 5 years lifetime again. So not much has changed from John's analysis in 2010. And he says, while we're getting better at fixing bugs, we're also adding more bugs. And of course, that brings us back to that T-shirt that we talked about a few months back of the, you know, 99 bugs on the wall, take one down, whatever it was, fix it, 113 bug, or not 99 bugs in the code, and then it's 113 bugs in the code, because this stuff is complicated, and so often now things we do have unintended consequences. So he says, and for many devices that have been built on a given kernel version, there have not been frequent or sometimes any security updates. So the bug lifetime for those devices is even longer. To really create a safe kernel, we need to get proactive about self-protection technologies. The systems using a Linux kernel are right now not running, or the systems using a Linux kernel are right now running with security flaws. Those flaws are just not known to the developers yet, but they're likely known to attackers. And we just discussed exactly such a story where this race condition was discovered from its use in the wild. But they're likely known to attackers, as there have been prior boasts / gray market advertisements for at least, and then he notes a couple common vulnerability numbers. So anyway, from my standpoint, I mean, we recognize now that very complex software is very difficult to make perfect. And we also know that security is by its nature in our current model. And I say that because I don't think it always has to be this way. But our current model is exactly sort of as he implies, is the weakest link. That is, security is a chain, and this the strength of the overall chain is limited by the strength of the weakest link. And every single one of them has to be strong. In the way our systems are designed today, unfortunately, that's the nature of it. I mean, so you could argue we're fighting a losing battle. The systems are inherently insecure. That is, their design promotes problems. So it's only by being as perfect as we can about not inducing problems which are sort of natural that we get security. So again, it's an uphill battle. And now with the IoT revolution and the fact that so many people are using tiny Linux microkernels pulling from the free open source code base in these devices, they're going to have these problems and they're never going to get fixed. I mean, even older mobile phones with Android are not going to get fixed. They're not going to get patched. So I've heard you talking, Leo, about, for example, the Pixel and how good it is that, you know, it's a phone you love and Google is 100% behind it. And we know that it's going to be kept current.
Well, for a couple of years anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the only problem. Even right. Google doesn't, like the Nexus right. 6 is already out of support.
Right.
Or will be in a couple of weeks.
And in fact, it was the 5 and the 6. It was a 5 specifically, but also the 6 that we'll be talking about shortly, that the DRAMer guys found as exploitable. So as soon as those phones are no longer maintained, they become platforms. Yeah. One little bit of errata from last week. I got a kick out of this. Someone shot me a tweet after the podcast to a CNET article whose headline was "Tech Luminaries Laud Dennis Ritchie 5 years after death."
Did they mention you?
No. I'm not a luminary, but the subtitle was "Well-known tech figures appear to have forgotten. The father of the C programming language died years ago, falling victim to social media's second death syndrome." Some of the tech's biggest names are paying tribute this evening to computing pioneer Dennis Ritchie. Ritchie was an internationally renowned computer scientist who created the C programming language. He also made significant contributions to the development of the Unix operating system, for which he received the Turing Award in 1983. The problem, especially if you look at it from Ritchie's perspective, is that he's been dead for five years, exactly 5 years. The time gap seems to have escaped some of the biggest names in tech, including Google CEO Sundar Pichai, who late Wednesday tweeted out Wired's 5-year-old obituary on Ritchie.
That's where it started. So you know what? That's where it started.
Thanking him for his immense contributions. Yeah. Yeah. And then Om Malik, a partner at True Ventures, and the founder of tech site GigaOm, who, of course, is a wonderful and frequent guest on your Twitter show, retweeted Pichai's tribute before soon recognizing his mistake and tweeting an apology for, quote, adding to the confusion and noise, which, of course, I also did last week. So I thought that was an appropriate bit of
errata. You did for moments and then corrected yourself. You know, in a way, it's fitting because one of the reasons I remember this vividly is because he died the same week Steve Jobs passed away. And Steve Jobs, of course, got all the ink. And I received numerous emails and there were many tweets from people who said, how come Steve gets all the credit? He created nothing. And Dennis Ritchie passes away and no one notices. And, of course, neither is exactly true. But, sure,
well,
5 years later.
Pop star versus, right. You know, our star. Right. You know, I mean, I'm waving my K&R book around. Yeah.
So I think, you know, in a way, it's kind of fitting that now all the noise about Steve Jobs has faded away. We can give Dennis the tribute he finally deserves.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering where this started, and I bet you it started with Sundar. It had to be somebody so influential that everybody else would say, and retweet it. Yep. And I saw those retweets, and I thought, this is weird, because I remembered it. And so that explains it. It's somebody so kind of godlike that no one would even say, well, let's see if that date's right.
You just don't bother doing a double take.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And in fact, you, even if you had doubts, you accuse yourself of being wrong.
Right. Oh, I must have forgotten or I must be mistaken.
Thinking about somebody else. Right. And of course, we did lose Dave Bunnell in this past week.
And Baranek of BBN, Bolt Baranek
and Newman. Yes.
Who's an interesting story because he was an acoustic engineer, formed BBM in Boston, and was invited by ARPA to design the early internet. And he, BBN did, in fact, and he passed away. He was 102.
Wow.
Yeah. So it shows you, invent the internet, live a long time. David Bunnell, sad to say, merely 69, which...
I know. And do we
as
know
we
anything?
Get into our 60s, sounds too young.
Hey, I'm there, baby. I'm too young. I'll be crossing.
Steve, they'll be talking about us soon enough. Believe me, we're getting into that territory now. But Bunnell was in many ways. I did not know
instrumental.
Him.
Instrumental. He was a key in the PC industry.
Yeah. Yep. He founded PC Magazine and PC World, arch rivals, Mac World Magazine, and was the inspiration. A mentor and, for many of the people we work with in the tech industry. Harry McCracken wrote a great article about him last week, too.
Do you remember PC Mag? It was every 2 weeks, and it was an inch thick.
You had to read it, and you had to read it.
And it was like 95% ads. Yeah, I mean, it was just it was the biggest cash cow the industry has ever seen.
No, one bigger. Computer Shopper magazine.
Oh, okay. That horrible oversized newsprint thing. You had to
huge.
Wash your hands.
It was tabloid size. It was 4 inches thick. I think it did have the merit of only coming out once a month. But I got it. I loved it also from Ziff Davis. I got it because that's where, you could peruse the ads. Now that with the internet, none of these have survived. Nobody prints this stuff anymore.
I got an award once from David Bunnell.
Did you? Did you? So you knew him?
Oh yeah, I knew him. I designed and inserted the highest pulling ad in the history of PC Magazine, and they gave me an award for that. Yeah,
wow.
It was a simple page. The headline was "Hard Disks Die." And then the subhead was "Ever Wonder Why?"
Oh,
and it was just a little bit of prose with some cool photos, but it was expensive. It was all Get Out because it was in PC Mag, but it pulled more than any other ad they ever ran.
Nice.
So because people understood that was the case back then.
Yeah.
I just did want to mention just complete random miscellany, but this AT&T Time Warner merger.
Wow.
I'm a free enterprise entrepreneur capitalist, but I recognize that our system has a problem, which is that power begets power, and when companies acquire an advantage, they use it to their own further advantage. And I guess in reading into this a little bit, as I have over the past week, there's been some suggestion that if this is allowed to proceed, then maybe some concessions can be obtained, like unbundling of cable packages and, other desirable things. But boy, here I am stuck with only one viable source of internet connectivity as an example of how the system fails the consumer when companies acquire, too much domination in a market. And this scares me as much as the Comcast and NBC Universal acquisition.
Yeah. It was very similar, isn't it?
Big, yeah. Yeah, it is a carrier acquiring content.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, let's hope our network neutrality legislation finally does come down doing the right thing, because this is worrisome. Yeah. You know, when a carrier has an interest in some content over other over competing organizations' content, that's just scary. Also, a little more on topic, at least relative to this podcast, this week in energy storage. I knew of this last week, but we were too crammed full of stuff. And so I thought, okay, I'm gonna just save this one for this week, because this isn't particularly time sensitive. But I just wanted to put it on our listeners' radar. You know, we've, as everyone knows, mobile energy storage is an interest of mine. We talked about supercapacitors and battery technology and, you know, nanotubes and all that. This comes out, this was a press release last week from the very well-known Oak Ridge National Laboratory. They, as often happens, accidentally discovered what they believe is an efficient process to turn, are you sitting down, Leo?
Yes.
CO2.
Oh, I saw this. Yeah.
Into ethanol.
Huge. I hope this is not bogus. I hope this is real.
This sure has all the smell of real.
Yeah.
And it uses inexpensive components at room temperature with a little electricity to catalyze the reaction.
So why is this a big deal, Steve?
Okay, so as we all know, we believe there's a problem with increasing levels of CO2 in the atmosphere.
It's not belief anymore. It's demonstrably true.
I'm trying not to be politically correct.
It's demonstrably true.
So, we know that that tends to have a heating of the planet effect. There's been a lot of talk about carbon sequestration that is trying to trap the CO2, and then they want to, like, you know, pump it back down into the dirt. And it's like, well, okay, but that just seems to be expensive with no return for the investment other than keeping, you know, green people happy. So what these guys have, and I'll read from the Oak Ridge National Laboratory's official release, in a new twist on waste to fuel technology, scientists at the Department of Energy, the DOE's Oak Ridge National Laboratory, have developed an electrochemical process that uses tiny spikes of carbon and copper, both abundant, to turn carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas, into ethanol. Their finding, which involves nanofabrication and catalysis science, was serendipitous. ORNL's Adam Rondione, lead author of the team's study published in Chemistry Select, said, quote, "We discovered somewhat by accident that this material worked. We were trying to study the first step of a proposed reaction when we realized that the catalyst was doing the entire reaction on its own. The team used a catalyst made of carbon, copper, and nitrogen and applied a voltage to trigger a complicated chemical reaction that essentially reverses the combustion process." I just love that phrase. "With the help of the nanotechnology-based catalyst, which contains multiple reaction sites, the solution of carbon dioxide dissolved in water turned into ethanol with a yield of 63%. Typically, this type of electrochemical reaction results in a mix of several different products in small amounts. So this is both very efficient and very selective." Adam continued, quote, "We're taking carbon dioxide, a waste product of combustion, and we're pushing that combustion reaction backwards with very high selectivity into a useful fuel. Ethanol was a surprise," he says. "It's extremely difficult to go straight from carbon dioxide to ethanol with a single catalyst. But this does that.
Amazing.
The system operates by dissolving CO2 in water at room temperature and with a bit of electricity produces ethanol. Wow. So again, for you know, when I see something like this, I think this is why we absolutely have to keep raw science funded.
Yeah.
You know, this kind of,
you never know.
Exactly. This, I mean, we got the internet from it, and now here's a potential win, because I mean, this makes it then feasible to just have big CO2 scoops, you know, suck it in. It CO2 dissolves easily in water, run it through this process, out comes gas.
Wow.
I mean, hello.
Hello.
I hope Elon knows about this. Maybe he just build this on to, you know, one of his next ideas.
Pretty amazing.
And finally, I just want to say that last night I hit 24% because I looked down at the little bar on my Kindle in Peter Hamilton's Night Without Stars.
Oh, okay.
So, and you know, I should know better by now, because he divides this into what he calls books, and the books have chapters.
Yeah.
And so book one, and I'm sorry, I go in, you know, last week and start learning about a whole bunch of new people, and I kind of get up to speed on them, and then I go to book two. It's like, okay. And now I got a whole, we got change location and new people, and it's like, oh, okay.
I just got up to speed on the first set.
Exactly. So then I got to learn all these people, and then I switch. Then I get into book three. It's like, oh no, and yet another a name I haven't seen before, and a whole new location. I'm thinking, oh, come on, and then, wham, it just took off like a rocket ship.
Yeah.
And I remembered having exactly this experience with Pandora's Star, where it was interesting, but it was like, okay, where are we going with this?
Right.
You know, I mean, because, you know, many books are written as sort of in a first person narrative, where you're looking out of the eyes of the protagonist, and as he walks around and talks about what's happening, or it's being described or something. Peter doesn't write that way. You know, Peter writes big, complex, sweeping, you know, stories. I mean, he's a real storyteller. And so he needs to set up the pieces and the people and, you know, establish. And so it took 24% of this book to establish what's going on. And then it just like, I kept looking at the clock last night thinking, oh, I gotta get up early to work on the podcast all day today. Anyway, so for what it's worth, oh boy, you know, we find out what happened with Bienvenido, which is where we left off on the first half of this duopoly or duology or whatever the heck it is. And it's really looking like another fun book. So
oh boy, I can't wait.
Yeah. 24% and fasten your seatbelt.
it's my next book. Yep.
Oh,
I have it on Audible. Of course I listen. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yes. Yeah. So, Colin Willis in Dorking, England, shot me a nice note, and you know, he's a listener, so he knows how to put in the subject line, Spinrite saves a guitar lesson. And he did a little smiley face. So he says, I worked from home today using my BitLockered. And I kind of like that, BitLockered. I've been BitLockered.
Yeah.
Using my BitLockered Windows 7 work laptop so that I could take my daughter to her guitar lesson. But last night, I thought I was going to have to go into the office and that we would have to skip the lesson because my laptop wouldn't boot. It had recently hung at some point during the boot, but had recovered at a second attempt. But last night, it repeatedly got stuck. Being a Security Now listener, almost from the start, I immediately thought of Spinrite. And of course, that's why I tell everybody about it every week, so that you immediately think about SpinRite. Instead of, what do I do? Who could not know at this point? So, and he says, Perens actually started around Snowden, but also recapped, and now just passed the Sugar Hill at 353 and reading Taubes. He's referring to Gary Taubes' book, of course.
Why we get fat.
Exactly. The work laptop is locked down such that I cannot boot my SpinRite CD, so I transferred the hard drive to my personal laptop and SpinWrote, he says, it quickly.
That's a new verb.
SpinWrote.
SpinWrote. New tense.
Yes. It quickly at level 2. Of course, the fact it was BitLockered didn't matter. And SpinRite cut through the disk like a knife through full fat butter and completed after about an hour. After that, the work laptop booted. I worked from home and we made it to the guitar lesson. Thanks for the great product. I am really, really looking forward to version 6.1. Colin, not as much as I am. So... and all of our SpinRite listeners are. So, Colin, thank you for sharing the news and helping me further plant the aha, I know how to fix this in our listeners' minds.
Aha. Well, let me plant something in your minds, and then we're going to talk about Drammer.
Oh, another sublime piece of work.
Yeah, Steve's got the scoop on this one. And I am going to, in real time, I'm all ready to do so, test it on the Pixel. I'm a little nervous, but we'll see what happens. But first, let's talk a little bit about our sponsor. I am leaving tomorrow night, late flight, overnight flight, to Gainesville, Florida, because I'm going out for the grand opening. And I don't ever do this for sponsors, but these guys, I am going to go out for the grand opening of their new studio for a couple of reasons. I'm talking about IT Pro TV. And the reason I want to go to the grand opening of their new studios is because I feel like we're very tightly connected. IT Pro TV is started by a couple of guys, Tim and Don, Tim Broom and Don Pezzett, who were IT trainers for years. So they, they've been teaching people the information they need to get the certs, to get better at their job, to get a better job, to get into IT. And they saw what we were doing, both at the Screensavers and then on Tech TV, and then here. In fact, they went to a panel I was on at NAB about what we were doing at Twit, and they said, we ought to do that for IT. So they created IT Pro TV, and in the few years they've been doing it, and have been advertising on this show, they have grown to the point now where they now are built. We built our new studio with two studios. They built a new studio with five studios, and that's why I've got to go out and see it. Maybe whine a little bit to Lisa. I am really thrilled for them. I'm really proud of them. And boy, if you are looking for a way to get those certs, or if you're in IT and you're really trying to get better at your job, take a look at IT Pro TV. More than 1,000 hours of content, and they're adding more every week. And, of course, with these new studios, they'll add even more every week. This month, in October, they're doing CCNA routing and switching. They're doing installation, storage, and compute with Server 2016. They're doing Windows operating fundamentals, Red Hat Linux, networking with Server 2016. They do Apple. They do Amazon. They do Cisco, CompTIA. If you want to be a certified ethical hacker, and who doesn't? They have 33 hours and 37 minutes covering everything you need to get the cert on hacking and countermeasures. I want this cert just to say I'm a certified ethical hacker. They've got them all. They even have a crypto courses, VMware. Of course, the bread and butter for an IT guy is being able to run Windows and Windows Server, and they've got it all. And even if you don't have Windows Server, you don't need it because they've got the virtual machine labs. All you need is an HTML5 browser, and you can create and manage and configure Windows Server and clients to your heart's content. Plus, you could take the exams before the exams with their Transcender practice exams. Those by themselves are worth $109. Everything you need. You want to get that A+, You want to learn to be a Cisco firewall guru or a Zen server master, a digital forensic investigator. It's all here. Subscriptions are the best value. You, by the way, they are the first, I think the only IT training company to sell courses directly on Amazon Video Direct. That's Amazon's new platform. But my suggestion is sign up for the free trial and see what it's like to have a subscription. And incidentally, if you're signed up for an enterprise account with a competitor and you've just received that email about the rates going up, IT Pro TV will match last year's pricing of your account so you and your team can continue to learn at an affordable rate. And you know what? You're going to like it better. That's why the entire Harvard IT department uses IT Pro TV and MIT, UCSD, and Stanford. I had the local Petaluma police detective call me. He said, I'm in charge of forensics now. I don't know anything about it. Can you tell me how to use Wireshark? I said, yeah. IT Pro TV. They've got the best course. It's 2 hours. It's easy. So, subscription, normally $57 a month or $570 a year. They take off 2 months if you buy a year. And a year's good, too, because you can download all the content and watch it anywhere. Although, even if you don't have that, you can watch on demand and live on your Chromecast, your Roku. They have an Amazon Fire TV app. They have an Apple TV app. Of course, you can watch it on your computer. But I got a better deal than $570 a year. Use the offer code SN30 at itpro.tv/securitynow. You will do two magical things. One, you'll send them a signal that you saw the ad on Security Now, and we like that because, you know, well, frankly, we want to keep Security Now on the air forever. And it's not, you know, a cheap show to do. So that's how we support it with these ads. And you're going to get a good deal for yourself. You're going to get 7 days free. And best of all, 30% off for the life of your account. What are they doing right now? Let's see. This is they're doing Project Plus right now. Tomorrow, Windows Operating System. They're going to be kind of busy on Thursday, the grand opening. And if you're in the Tampa, Jacksonville, Orlando area, come to Gainesville Thursday. I'll be there October 27th, 6 to 8 p.m., there's going to be a studio tour. There'll be food, drinks. There's going to be dancing, live music. Lisa and I are going out just for this. We're taking a red eye there, and we'll fly back afterwards. We don't want to miss it, and you won't want to miss it. So if you're in that area, stop by. You're invited. Just go to itpro.tv. There's an invitation information there. And again, 30% off means it's as little as $40 a month. It's a really good deal. itpro.tv/securitynow. Don't forget the offer code SN30. Congratulations to Tim and Don and the whole team. They've put something amazing together. All right, Steve, I sit here poised with my finger over the install button.
So what Leo is referring to is the fact that these guys who have revealed this new Rowhammer version of an attack that they named DRAMMER. Or Drammer, it can stand for DRAM hammer, or also deterministic row hammer, because that's one of the innovations of their particular implementation of this. They have produced a side loadable tester that runs in Android devices. They have been expecting Google Play to host it for formal availability, but it has not yet appeared in the Google Play Store. So I tried it last night. I meant to try it on a Kindle Fire, but I did try it on an older Samsung device. And, you know, when I clicked the link and tried to run the .apk file, I got the notice that the device is not configured to allow unauthorized software to run. So, and of course, and I clicked the settings and went in, and I said, yes, I do want to drop my shields for a moment. And so then I allowed that to happen and ran the APK. And I, you know, it doesn't have a fancy UI. You can see it allocating some memory, and then it produces a log if over time it manages to induce bit flips in the DRAM of your particular Android device. You know, I'm a trusting person. I trust these guys. So I don't have a problem. It's coming from their site, vvdveen.com/drammer/drammer.apk.
Oh, man, I'm trusting you on this one because this is against every instinct I have. But you trust them.
If there was any way to – well, I mean, I'm in a dialogue with
– Now, we should say that the tester is not open source because otherwise they'd be publishing exploit code.
Correct.
Right. So should I do it?
Yes, do it.
So this is a Pixel. This is the new Google phone, which in theory, and it has all patches applied, would be as secure as it could be. Now, note – even after you turn on the install from third-party sources, which it warns you against, you'll get this further warning, installation blocked, Drammer. This app contains code that attempts to bypass Android security protections. I'm encouraged, by the way, that you see stuff like this.
Yes.
One would hope that it would see that in other applications. If you could say okay and it won't install it, but if you say more details, it'll say even if you've heard of this app, or the app developer, it's still dangerous to install an app from an untrusted source. They warn you three times. Now I'm going to say install anyway.
Yeah, because these people are not untrusted. I mean, they are, they're on our side.
Right.
I mean, they told Google about this.
I think it installed. Did it install? Let me do it again just to make sure. More details. Install anyway. There we go. Okay. App installed. Now I'm going to open it. It downloads something. Should I do check whether your device is vulnerable to Rohammer bug, relaxed or aggressive? Should I go all the way?
Yeah, crank it up.
Why? In for a penny, in for a pound. And then you can send statistics or not about the test result. Of course, I'll help them out. And then I love the button. Hammer time. Now, you're saying, and I'm seeing it, the log.
Yeah, and I didn't get the log on mine.
Well, it just crashed is what happened.
Did it say flipped in those entries?
Well, it crashed.
Let's try it again. So
it's reboot. It's crashing out. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
And what I'm wondering is, I see there's a little block. There are like memory allocations, which I'll explain in a minute.
Exhaust frag, low memory, boom.
Okay. So
is that good or bad? I don't know.
Oh, it means nothing. It just means that it's raw code that they put together and that hasn't been widely tested.
Right.
Although they as I'll explain, they've tested it on a whole lot of devices. So there may be something about the Pixel, which is a little bit different. And I imagine it will evolve. And maybe that's why it hasn't appeared in the Google Store. They might be waiting to tweak it a little bit.
Aggressiveness. Would that make it maybe more reliable?
Oh, that might vary. How about put it back where it was, a little, like only half an inch over from the left?
Right. It crashed again.
Okay.
But I'm going to keep turning it down until it doesn't, right? Boom. Now, I don't know if it's actually crashing because I see it in the recents.
It is deliberately coming up against an out-of-memory condition, and I'll explain why they're doing that.
Okay.
And so that's on purpose, but it's a little – oh, now it didn't.
No, and not. It's just slower.
Okay.
It's going to take a while. But I saw the same thing. This is, by the way, all the way relaxed. And it's reading from page 0 and page X equals 0 to 128. So, and then eventually it's going to say exhausted, and then it's going to say out of memory.
Right.
And that's when it usually crashes. So what is it doing here?
Okay. So the background, our listeners who've been following the podcast for 2 years will remember that we first discussed this, what was initially a theoretical, this doesn't sound good problem. And as so often is the case, things that start out as, oh, that's not good. But, it seems like it will be hard to exploit. Well, a few months ago, we talked about the flip feng shui. And in fact, that was the title for that podcast, where this same group there at the UV University in Amsterdam, led by Professor Herbert Boss, there's a team of researchers that work with him and a trio from UC Santa Barbara in this case. These are the guys who figured out how a process running in a shared hosted environment could arrange to flip the bit in the public key in an adjacent process, rendering that public key factorable, and then factor it and immediately use that modified public key to securely access with full privileges that other process. So to do that, they had to do some amazing, gymnastics, essentially, very clever, where they were able to use the fact that these virtualized environments do page coalescing, deduplicating, which is coalescing, where any duplicate pages are being looked for constantly by a background thread. And if they're found, the page tables, which describe each process's mapping of logical to physical memory, the page tables are modified so that both instances of logical memory in the two processes refer to the same physical memory. And this is a highly effective memory saving technique that that modern virtual environments provide. So these guys were able to leverage, to take the raw capability of, okay, if we pound on memory, our own memory, which is the only memory we have access to, we can flip a bit in it. And so you first think, well, how's that going to be useful? Well, they turned it into something that was an actual attack. Now, now they're back. So they call this one DRAMer. And as I mentioned, I think of it as DRAM hammer. But on the other hand, all row hammers are DRAM hammers, because this is a fundamental problem with DRAM. Just to remind our listeners, the DRAM is arranged in a grid array, and the nature of the dynamic RAM is such that rows, entire strips, strip rows are refreshed and read at the same time. And it turns out that designers have shrunk the cell size of DRAM, as they're always doing, in the same way they push the margins out of hard drives, and then they push the margins out of lithium ion cells, trying to squeeze as much usable surface area as they can at the cost of manufacturing tolerances being reduced. They've also squeezed DRAM cells down to where they still work when they're this small. It's like, unless you create a lot of noise in the neighborhood. And so that's what this does. This creates a noisy neighborhood. And if you have particularly weak cells that are not being refreshed at a high enough rate, you can cause them to misread. You can flip the bits from 0 to 1 or 1 to 0. So the question had been, that had never been answered before, because all of the row hammer attacks to date have been on x86 and in Intel x64 platforms, never on the ARM platform. And of course, most mobile devices are ARM-based because it's so efficient with battery power for the computing that you get out of the power consumption. So they decided to tackle the ARM platform. The first problem, and in a realistic environment, not just some raw ARM chip on a board, but a existing smartphone, Android-based phones and tablets, Android-based ARM tablets or ARM devices. So from the beginning of their abstract, they said, we show that deterministic row hammer attacks are feasible on commodity mobile platforms, and that they cannot be mitigated by current defenses. Rather than assuming special memory management features, our attack, DRAMer, solely relies on the predictable memory reuse patterns of standard physical memory allocators. We implement DRAMMer, or DRAMMer, I don't know how they pronounce it, on Android / ARM, demonstrating the practicality of our attack, but also discuss a generalization of our approach to other Linux-based platforms. To support our claims, we present the first Rowhammer-based Android root exploit, relying on no software vulnerability and requiring no user permissions. In addition, we present an analysis of several popular smartphones and find that many of them are susceptible to our DRAMMer attack. We conclude by discussing potential mitigation strategies and urging our community to address the concrete threat of faulty DRAM chips in widespread commodity platforms. So, the first thing they needed to do was to see, was to verify experimentally that the DRAM memory in existing ARM-based smartphones could be subject to Rowhammer. There was some suggestion in the researcher community that DRAM required faster repeat writes to DRAM than the memory controllers in these devices might support. So it might be as that whereas the DRAM itself could be faulty, the DRAM controller wouldn't allow a high enough bandwidth writing to inflict the Rowhammer of fault on the underlying hardware. So they first had to determine whether that was possible or not. Now, in order to found on DRAM, you need to get the cache out of the way. We've talked about caching, how for example, in modern Intel architectures, you have a hierarchy of caches, the L1, the L2, and the L3 cache. And so any attempt to write is typically written through to the DRAM, but if you write it again, the cache realizes writing the same thing you just wrote, so it discards it. And so that write doesn't get propagated down into the hardware because the cache is already synchronized with what's in the hardware, and so it saves that write cycle, which is also a benefit for performance in a busy system. So in order to bypass the cache on the Intel platforms, there is a cache flush instruction which is available from user land, from ring 3, from where normal user code executes. And remember also that in the intervening time, Google found that there was a Rowhammer vulnerability that they were able to inflict in Chrome because their NACL, their native code execution, had not ruled out the use of the Intel cache flush. Well, they simply changed that native code interpreter in order to make that no longer possible. So that solved the problem. That is, if you can't flush the cache, you can't do Rowhammer because the cache will get in the way. In a very similar way to the DDoS attacks we were talking about at the top of the podcast. So the first problem was that whereas the cache flush is a non-privileged instruction on the Intel platform, it is privileged on the ARM. So this is, wait a minute. That means that an application running in user space has no ability to flush the cache through the instruction that is present in the ARM architecture, but only available to privileged code. So the first thing they did was they said, okay, let's just not worry about doing this from user land. Let's first figure out whether the DRAM controller can permit this. So they wrote a a kernel loadable module in order and their own kernel code just for the moment to be able to run the to have access to the privileged cache flush instruction. They pounded on DRAM and they got bits to flip all over the place. So they said, okay, if we can come up with a way of doing rowhammer without the cache flush instruction, which is not available to us from user land, then we've got something to work from. Turns out, again, these guys, I don't think anything could stop them. I just, as I said, I am so glad they're on our side, because turns out that there is a way to pound on memory without having to flush the cache. And that's from direct memory access. DMA inherently avoids the cache because you need to keep the view of different DMAing processes coherent, meaning that you can't have any situation where cache might contain data which has been modified but not yet written to DRAM. So DMA, direct memory access, is a cache bypassing process. So they were able to come up – oh, and DMA is available to user land processes, all kinds of things, things doing video and webcam apps and even audio. I mean, all kinds of things need high bandwidth access to main memory for reading and writing. So that's something reliably available, certainly on the Android platform and probably everywhere. So they explain that this for this they consider DRAMer to be a particular instance of the larger flip feng shui technology. So for flip feng shui in general to be successful, three requirements have to be met. An attacker needs to be able to hammer sufficiently hard one way or the other, hitting the memory chips with high frequency, because no bit flips will occur if the memory controller is too slow. And now they know that they're able to do that. Also, physical memory needs to be manipulatable and manipulated so that exploitable data can be located in a vulnerable physical page. And we saw them do that in a different instance using this memory deduplication on a VM platform. They don't have that environment in Android, but they needed some way to do that. And physical memory mapping must be determinable to allow what's known as double-sided row hammering. That is where when you hammer a row, you are writing to the row of cells adjacent to another row. Double-sided row hammering typically ping-pongs between the row above and the row below the target hammered row, really just hammering the crap out of it. But in order to be able to do that, you have to know how the actual bits on the chip are organized, and they designed a heuristic that allowed them to figure out on any given platform the row length in bits so that they were able to relate logical addresses to actual physical rows on the grid of DRAM. Like I said, you know, you want these guys on your side. So none of those three requirements were initially met with any of the previous research that had been done on rowhammer. They had to fulfill those like from scratch in order to move this over into the ARM platform and make it workable. So with all of this background, here's what they do. They allocate a single physically contiguous block of memory. Now, the good news is allocating memory for DMA does that because DMA solves two problems for them. Not only does it cache, but it also allows for the explicit allocation of physically contiguous memory, because you need physically contiguous memory because the DMA is writing to the physical memory, which the process sees a logical view of through the memory mapper that exists in the system, the memory management system. So it's necessary to have the logical to physical mapping and physically contiguous DMA pages, because the DMA just works with a physical counter, and when it's streaming data in or out of memory, it just does that by incrementing the counter byte by byte or block by block as it's writing, and just going for however long you tell that the buffer is. So they allocate a big contiguous block of memory, then they deallocate it and immediately reallocate as a ton of tiny blocks of memory. So and this is the deterministic aspect of what they've done. So because we know how Android manages memory and how its memory allocator works. And I mean, it's open source, it's public domain, you can probe it. And so, you know, that's a given. So they allocate a single huge block of memory, then they release it and immediately basically request all of that memory again in tiny blocks. And what happens is the way Android manages memory is it uses page tables, which will be located out in the physical space in between blocks of pages that the page tables describe. So it's a way of essentially forcing a layout of memory which is deterministic and well known and gives them the property that they want, which is these page description tables exist at essentially knowable periodicity within this large region. Now, then here's the kick, or the trick is the page tables are exclusively the property of the kernel. They are kernel memory management structures, which are absolutely off limits to any user code, because the users just see an abstraction of memory through the memory manager. The OS is managing the actual physical allocation, but you absolutely cannot allow a process to mess with its own memory management, because that would be giving it the keys to the kingdom. That's something that only the privileged OS is able to do. So what these guys figured out a way to do was, after templating, they allocate this big block of DRAM, then they hammer the crap out of it in order to find all the flippable bits within the region of memory that they have access to. So they call that templating. They template the memory. And by the way, the templating code is up on GitHub in public domain for people to experiment with if anyone's interested. So they template the memory. Then knowing how the memory is laid out, they are able to use the row hammer they template the memory, fragment it, deliberately fragment it, which is going to sprinkle page table management structures throughout that fragmented region, which they technically no longer have access to because that's OS. Those are OS-owned blocks, which they can't see. But because they know where it must be, they have been able to arrange for those management blocks to fall in areas with soft flippable bits. So then they hammer, as they have already proven they can, on a row adjacent to a row of memory that is in one of these page tables, which flips the bit and maps the page table into user memory. Once again, they flip a bit. Now, again, because this is a hardware flaw, the operating system just thinks they're a strange app. You know, okay, he's writing a lot to this couple locations, but, you know, who cares? Well, that induces an unseen bit flip in the hardware, in the memory management system. And they've engineered that bit flip so that the page table then appears in their user memory. Now they have just been given something no application should ever have. That is an OS memory management structure that they have full read and write access to because they've tricked the hardware and mapped that into their own process memory space. So that means they can point entries in the page table, which they now control, to any physical memory in the system, including the kernel memory. So they do that to scan through the kernel memory, looking for the well-known process management structure, the process credentials, where the UID and the GID and other common Linux structures are stored. They find the structure for their process, that is, the structure in the OS, which is managing the rights and privileges of their process, and they simply give themselves root access. They manipulate their own credential structure to grant themselves root access, and they now have full access to the entire system. So they start as an application like any other that needs zero permission, and simply by manipulating a weakness in the hardware, they get control of critical kernel structures, give themselves root access, and then they have the keys to the kingdom. And the bad news is there's no clear solution for this. They, on their page, they show a range of existing current generation smartphones which are vulnerable. How many have been tested? How many of those have found flippable bits? Most have, a few haven't. Google has known about this for a month. The problem is there's no clear solution. When we were talking about mitigating this back in the Flip Feng Shui episode, we talked about the next generation of DDR memory, which would notice that access had been particularly heavy in a given region and increase the refresh of any rows that might be susceptible to rowhammer attacks, sort of a dynamic refresh. Another approach is just to crank up the refresh rate. That, as we know, it does take a hit on performance and it does consume more power. And mobile devices are, if nothing else, very sensitive to power consumption. So basically, they have demonstrated that a two-year-old theoretical flaw does affect a wide number of existing ARM-based mobile devices, that unprivileged software can give itself root access, and it takes about 30 seconds overall to do this. And it's not clear how this thing gets mitigated. The problem is it's not a flaw in any code. It's a flaw in the hardware that we are trusting not to have its bits flipped. And they've shown they can. Beautiful piece of work.
Now, I re-ran the thing with the relaxed mode all the way up, and it did complete, but it didn't give me any report. So I don't know what to think about DRAMer and the Pixel. Okay. Does that mean it's it passed? It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, the fact that it shouldn't have crashed. Mine didn't crash.
Sounds like it's safe.
Yeah, and they don't have a big UI on it yet. Right. They are presenting this toward the end of this week, which is why it came out of embargo and the world knows about it. Dan Gooden wrote a great piece in Ars Technica, and you know, and I started getting, as I knew I would, tweets about it yesterday when the news broke. So we'll keep an eye on it. I don't know how soon Google's going to have patches out, and it's not clear how they're going to mitigate this.
Yeah.
So for
apparently
our
5X is not vulnerable. So I wondered, does DDR4 vulnerable? Does that make it invulnerable because it's DDR4, or does it matter?
Both 3 and 4 are. They did find some DDR4 that is vulnerable.
This is DDR4.
Yeah. And there's a next generation DDR4 which does incorporate adaptive refresh. And so that's probably what's going to happen. But the problem is, look at all the hardware that's already out there.
Right.
I mean, you know, this is so
unpatchable. I mean,
it's not clear how you fix this.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it looks like what I would guess from the warning I got is that Google at least is scanning for software that tries to do stuff like this, or tries to do something anyway. Because I did get this unsafe software. You have to override this to not merely that it's untrusted source, but that it's literally unsafe. So that's encouraging. Did you get that on your 5X?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. And I wonder if that's something new. Now, you said your 5X was vulnerable, right?
No. In fact, it was a Samsung. It's an old Samsung.
Oh, you did it on an old Samsung.
It's an old Samsung tablet.
They said 12 of the 15 fives were vulnerable. I don't know. It's unclear. They only tried one 5X. So more to come, obviously.
They refer to their Nexus 5 as like their old beat up warhorse.
Right.
I think, you know, this is the one that they subject to everything. And so one question they had was whether this might be usage fatigue. You know, might there be a more prone tendency for bits to flip on well-hammered DRAM.
It's worn out. It's all worn out.
Although there isn't an electrochemical process that we know of to describe that. You know, for example, we know exactly why, flash RAM fatigues and dies over time. We know why we need wear leveling and to limit the number of writes for flash. DRAM doesn't have that characteristic. So I suspect it isn't usage-based, but it certainly could be also the case that even the same model phone in batches is made with slightly and subtly different DRAM. You know, because they just say we need 4 gigs of DRAM, and they buy some batches from this supplier and some batches from that supplier. So even things like little process to process variations are, I mean, because we're down at the margins, but as with this demonstrates, margins matter.
Yep. All right, ladies and gentlemen, there you have it. The scoop of the century.
Well, so for our listeners who probably without fail want to run this DRAM test, if you just Google DRAMMER, DRAMMER, you'll find the article and the page. It's in the show notes this week. It's from these guys. I trust them. And all it's doing is seeing whether it doesn't do any exploiting. It just looks for flippable bits.
Yeah.
And in fact, if somebody finds them, send me a tweet. I'd love to know that some listeners found flippable bits in their phones.
And of course, I immediately uninstalled it and rebooted just in case.
Yeah, good.
Just in case. And I'm deleting the APK right now. Well, thank you, Steve. I don't know. My results were inconclusive on the Pixel, but I'm sure we'll learn more in time. We do this show every Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC, if you want to watch live at twit.tv and be in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. But if you can't, don't worry. On-demand audio and video also available at Steve's site, grc.com. Actually, he does audio, and he has something unique there. He has transcripts. You'll also find, of course, SpinRite, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. You'll find many freebies. Steve's very good on that. Shields up. Might be a useful thing if you have an IoT device running. I'm sorry. No. That shields up would be for the cow, the dirty cow. Test your network for a dirty cow.
I can't believe they called it that. Oh.
and of course, everything else. It's a great site, grc.com. But do come to our site, twit.tv/sn, if you want to subscribe or download video. We have that. And any podcast app will have the latest version. Subscribe. That way you get them all. Complete your set. All 800 and, what is it? No, 583 versions of this show. We're going to keep doing it till we get it right. Or till the internet is safe, whichever comes first. That's going to be a long time, Steve. Thanks so much.
Yes, we're not going to run out of anything to talk about. We'll do a Q&A next week, unless all of the world's toasters decide to gang up
revolt
and attack the internet and bring the world to its knees.
By the way, you can ask Steve questions, grc.com/feedback, but he's also on Twitter at SGGRC, and you can DM him there and ask a question there. He uses Twitter questions as well.
And thanks, we Steve. Will see you next week. Thanks, Leo. Security.